All right, it's now time for our main speaker. Please welcome Andy from Laguna Beach.
Oh, man. Asphalt Andy, alcoholic. I want to thank Greg for the opportunity to participate in this meeting. He's around here somewhere. If you don't like what I see this guy after. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it. Welcome to the new people. I actually wrote down the new people so I wouldn't forget. Thomas, Cameron, Steve, George, Jonathan, Bradley, Arnie, and Billy. Keep coming back. Thanks, you guys. And happy birthday to Jeremy and Matt, guys. It's really inspirational to see that. I'm an alcoholic, and I have a sponsor. I go to 3 meetings a week. I have a sobriety date. It's Monday, August 23rd, 1998. And I know it's a Monday because I thought I was a badass musician, but my musician career pinnacled at the Sandpiper. Anybody? Sandpiper? Everybody's favorite dive bar, right? They serve till 1:45. What else can I say? And so that was the top of my career. Every Monday, there were more people in the band than at the Sandpiper. So things weren't going so well for me, but I knew for sure, that was the high point of my week, that I got through an entire gig at the Sandpiper, played until 1:45, went home, and my head hit the pillow. I was sober. And that's why I picked that day. Yeah. If you're new, I can tell you the best thing that ever happened to me was getting sober. And I did not feel that way when I first got here. But I will tell you after 26 years that everything good in my life today is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. People in meetings like all of you guys and girls and my sponsor and the meetings that I go to and the countless hours that men have sat with me and given to me for fun and for free in AA and walked me through the steps and suggested things like go to meetings and get commitments and, hey, have you heard about this men's retreat and all the things that we do to stay sober. For that, forever grateful, because my life is good today. I mentioned that my nickname was Asphalt Andy because when I got here, I had a bunch of asphalt and gravel just ground across the front of my face. And it took 3 years and 3 plastic surgeries. I found a sober plastic surgeon. It took him 3 years and 3 surgeries to get all the asphalt and gravel out. And because towards the end of my drinking, I had an alcoholic girlfriend, and we loved to run. And see where this is heading. We were marathon runners, and we never ran more than like 3 or 4 miles at a time, but we were grandiose alcoholics. So we were marathon runners, and we're at the beach one day drinking like we do at the beach, and it started raining. And I'm a good, well, I was selfish, but, you know, I was thought it would put me in her good graces. So I decided to give a piggyback ride and get home. And I lived at the cottage across the street from the women's club where they have the Gucci meeting. At the time, and I didn't know anything about AA or that there had been a meeting there for 50 years, or anything. Probably would have helped if I did. But I'm running, and I've got her, giving her a piggyback ride, just running full trot across Coast Highway in the rain. And I remember thinking, maybe this isn't such a good idea. And they had just freshly paved the asphalt driveway on that driveway. And there's a little bit of a rise there, and then it levels out. Well, I got to the rise, and we fell on my face. And fortunately, she was fine. She just landed on me. But I couldn't get my hands out, right? And I couldn't. And I didn't want to lose my nose and my chin and stuff. So I just bared down and just ground my little alcoholic dome along the asphalt. And she just rode, you know, rode me in. And that's how it was. And we were too drunk to go to the hospital. So she just put a bunch of bandages on me until it stopped bleeding. And then I went to work the next day. And I went to a doctor a couple months later, a real doctor. And I remember he looked at me and he said, "You have a post-traumatic asphalt tattoo." He said, I've only seen this on motorcycle accident victims who get it like on their arms and their legs when they grind across the street. And he literally said, but I've never seen it on somebody's face. Oh, I just, okay, man. But, you know, and I didn't know then about the physical allergy or the mental obsession or the dark spiritual, you know, problems I would have later. I just knew I liked to drink a lot. And then I sometimes got into trouble with that. And many years later, I would come to realize what that was. My fucking heart is racing right now. I was actually talking to Tim before the meeting about this. It's probably normal to standing in front of a lot of people, but as an alcoholic, you think it'd be great to stand and talk about yourself for an hour or whatever. But man, I used to treat my alcoholism with alcohol and a lot of accelerants. And this is, I'm telling you guys, this is like the old days. It's like a free buzz right now. It's great. So thank all of you for helping me with this. So I didn't know any of the stuff about alcoholism. And I had my first drink when I was 12. And I just thought that it was part of like human nature to be interested in altered states. But it turns out I was really just a crazy alcoholic 12-year-old. And I grew up in an area where all my friends were Jewish. And I was the only kid who wasn't. So I went to a lot of bar mitzvahs. And basically it's a big party. Parents throw a bunch of their kids at parties. And I felt out of place because my parents weren't throwing any money at me, and I didn't have a suit, and all these 13-year-old kids, and I was 12. I mean, it was just horrible. You know how you feel awkward and little and small? And but at the back of the convention hall, a big hall like this, they had full-size trash cans full of ice and champagne. And me and another kid, we went back there, and I remember I drank 3 or 4 bottles of champagne by myself, 12 years old, at this party. And the parties go a long time, so we had plenty of time to get hammered. And I remember by the end of the night, I was in the playground at the back of this big whatever facility it was, and there was a rope swing, and I'm on the rope swing, dancing, and there's other kids around, like, cheering me on. And I'm having a great time. Like, this alcohol thing is work, and all of a sudden I can like have a good time. And these two girls come out of the door from the convention, and they're 14-year-old girls. And they go, hey, are you Andy? And I'm like, this booze thing is awesome. Girls are asking for my name already. And I said, yes, yeah, I'm Andy. And they said, your mom's asking for you. So God, just total buzzkill. And I went in and embarrassed my family in front of all these people, all their friends, and all these. I remember adults looking at me, and I thought it was no big deal, right? But I had friends who have 12-year-old kids, and like, they're little kids. And I was like fucked up at this party and thought it was great. Told all my friends about it at school the next week and went about my business. And from 12 years old until I finally got back to AA a few months before my 30th birthday, I always drank for the effect produced by alcohol. I always thought it was strange when they would say that, you know, in the big book and stuff. I'm like, why else would you drink? Isn't that the point? I'm going to drink 3 or 4 bottles of champagne or whatever's around because I like the effect produced by alcohol. It's just what I like to do. It makes me feel good. And I didn't know any of this stuff until much, much later. So somehow I got through high school and got into a decent college down here. And that's what got me down into Irvine. And along the way, my other passion aside from drinking was guitar. And I loved playing guitar. And I would spend countless hours in my room, drunk or on other stuff, and trying to make my guitar sound like Jimi Hendrix or Eric Clapton or Jimmy Page or any countless number of these guitar players. And I could never get it right, but I would try and try and try. So by the time I got into college, I brought my guitar with me and a lot of booze and other stuff. And I remember somebody heard me playing in the dorms. And they said, hey, there's a band that needs a guitarist. You should go audition. And so I went to this audition, but I think I was like antisocial and drunk and high and stuff. It didn't go well. So I didn't get the gig, but the drummer said, hey, I've got another band. You should come audition for this band. And I said, fine. And so I went to this other audition. And at this time, the number one band had just finished a world tour. And they were on their third number one album. Back then, people put out vinyl albums. They had a huge number one album with all kinds of hits, and they were on regular radio play on MTV. Anybody? Music? Remember when they used to play videos? Their videos were playing on MTV all the time. These guys were huge. And I'm sitting at this band audition, and the singer comes in, and he looks exactly like the singer for this band. And then he starts singing, and he sounds exactly like this band that's the number one band in the world at the time. And I just couldn't believe it. This is golden. So we learned 10 or 12 of their best songs, and we start playing at local clubs. When I was 17 years old, I was playing every week in Laguna Beach. And then eventually we started playing at USC every Thursday, which is their big night. And we got a production contract, and we wrote some crappy songs that nobody's ever heard of. But we had fun, you know what I mean? And we started doing these little tours, and drinking was all free, you know what I mean? I mean, it was like Bill Wilson says, booze took on a new energy or whatever. It was working for me. It was a lot of fun. And along the way, I got to meet this girl. And I got no game or social skills, really. But because I'm in the band, I get to meet this girl. And she was an angel. She was my college girlfriend. And that was going really well. And then I graduated somehow. It took me 6 years to get my four-year degree because I was pretty distracted from school and all this other stuff. But finally, somehow, I got out, and the band broke up. And I was just destroyed. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life because that's all I wanted to do. My first job out of college, I got a psychology degree from UC Irvine because I was trying to figure out what was wrong. And my first job was Guitar Center because that's all I wanted to do is be around guitars and kind of work in there. And then teaching as a guitar instructor and playing in these local clubs. But the band broke up and I didn't know what to do. And then my girlfriend went and got into law school and she broke up with me. And I remember she called me and she said, I never thought I would be the one whose feelings would change. I still remember it this day. And I was destroyed. I was depressed. Somebody in my family explained to me later the physiology behind heart attack. And it's very, very similar on a chemical level to coming off cocaine and morphine. And I was just devastated. It hurt and I'd cry on the way to work every day. I had a lot of trouble getting over it. It's because I had never developed as an individual guy. I was always leaning on these relationships. And so when she left, there was nothing. There was nothing left. It's funny, I can still kind of feel it. It's been a long time ago. I mean, I didn't know what to do. Years later, my sponsor would tell me, Andy, it's pretty simple. She had an easy decision to make. Either go to law school and have a life or be with you. I saw him too. You know those sponsors I'm talking about, those guys? He didn't. He was a little abrasive, but it's exactly what I needed. He was a good guy. And so for a long time after that, nothing happened. I mean, really, nothing happened. There's a guy, Scott Redman, one of my favorite speakers. He used to tell a joke about watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's a lot of activity, but no movement. And that's what was going on in my life. I smoked weed all the time and got drunk all the time and just couldn't get any traction in my life. And my friends started going to grad school. And my stepbrother went to med school. And my friends started getting married. And that really hurt because I had to start being in weddings. And I remember there's nothing worse than like an untreated alcoholic like me at a wedding. I can't be happy for you or anybody else. All I'm thinking about is, oh, my girlfriend broke up with me. So I can't be happy for you. It was miserable. And nothing happened for years like this. I just kept drinking and using. At one of those weddings, I drove a friend home, my friend Brad, and I was in my alcoholic car. We've all had that last ala car, you know what I mean? The last one that you have. It was an 86 Honda Civic hatchback, and Brad needed a ride home. So I threw him in the car after drinking all night at one of these weddings and drove him home doing 125 miles an hour. And my stepbrother found out. I'll never forget, he called me. And he said, Andy, did you drive Brad home on Laurel Canyon doing 125 miles an hour in your little shitty car? And I said, yeah, you know what? I think this is a problem. And I'll never forget. I was in that little cottage across from the women's club. I remember looking at the ceiling and going like, yeah, this is a problem. And I had checked into AA in between during this time and kind of checked it out. And I remember thinking, you know what? I need to make some changes here. I need to quit driving. Right? Because I'm not going to quit drinking. So I just stayed in Laguna. I just didn't drive. The last drink I had was 4th of July, 1998. Some guys drove me up to LA and I did a gig. and made some money, and then started in North Laguna at the Royal Hawaiian. Anybody? Royal Hawaiian? Lapu Lapu? Yeah. Had some of those, and then just worked my way to the Sandpiper all the way at the end of the night. 1:30 had last call at the Sandpiper. And I remember thinking, I got to go to my Coke dealer's house in South Laguna. I got to get in my car. And so I ran home because I like to run. And I had to use my roommate's phone because I couldn't pay my phone bill. And I called my Coke dealer, and he was up. And, you know those guys? This guy. And I don't think, yeah, that's a whole other story. And he said, yeah, come on down. So I got in my car. And the last night that I drank and drove was that night. And anybody familiar with Laguna, there used to be a pier at Aliso Beach. That time, I mean, it was still there. But at Aliso Beach, the cops wait for all the drunks to leave Laguna after 2. So by then, it was like 2:15, and I blacked out, crashed my car, hit the curb, blew out both right tires, bent both rims, and bounced into the middle of Coast Highway, looking at that driveway where those guys always hang out, and they just weren't there that way. I just got lucky. So I just pulled over and changed the tire and went to my Coke dealer's house, of course. And if you've been in AA for a while, there's sometimes these disputes about what's an alcoholic and what's an addict. You know, there's sometimes a little timer available, as we do sometimes, about that. Well, the book tells me I'm supposed to cease fighting everything one, so I don't have a dog in that fight. But I will tell you that I was so drunk when I went to my Coke dealer's house. He took one look at me and said, oh my God, man, you're too drunk. Why don't you just crash here in my waterbed? Like, I was too drunk for my Coke dealer, right? And I did. I stayed in his waterbed. And I remember waking up and realizing, like, shit, I'm in this guy's waterbed. Oh no, did anything happen? You know? Maybe it did, but I got out of there and got a taxi and drove home. And the last drink I ever had was a warm half beer that was on top of the and I drank that and had my moment of clarity. And it wasn't good. I remember thinking, if this is how it's going to be, I guess I better go back to AA. And I was not feeling happy about it. I was not looking forward to seeing your smiling face. Right? But I finally knew it with 100% certainty, this is how it's going to be now. I can't blame the girlfriend or my family or the cops or anything else. This is on me. And I knew it's going to be like this or worse forever. And I was scared to death of what would happen if I took one drink, because I knew I didn't know if I'd get my car. I could no longer say with any certainty that I'd get my car. And it was just a matter of time until I hit somebody or killed myself. I ended up in jail for a while. And I got sober. In noon meetings at the Laguna Beach Canyon Club. I'm here to tell you, it's possible to get sober in noon meetings at the Canyon Club. I worked at night as a musician. So I remember somebody told me, hey, you should go to noon meetings there. And I went there 5 days a week. And after a month, I knew I was going to drink. Because if I don't have an adequate substitute, like it talks about in the book, if I'm not working a program, if I don't have something, but I'm not drinking, it gets really, really uncomfortable. The depression kicks in, the resentments. I didn't even know what that was. The committee was in full force, and it was all negative, right? And so I smoked pot because I needed something, man. Like, I think I needed to watch a movie or something. So I'm like, well, I gotta smoke some weed. And I stopped going to meetings right away. And I remember I found myself on the beach, high, sure that there were some people behind me talking about me. And I just went to the beach like this for like an hour. And I finally had the like courage to look back, and there's nobody there, man. I'm just a wreck. And so I came back to AA because I knew if I'm smoking weed, it's just a matter of time until I drink again. And I got a month again. And I remember thinking, I got to drink. This is so horrible. The alcoholic thinking is what I really relate to still today. I didn't understand the spiritual malady, but at the time, man, the alcoholic thinking was bad. And I remember I was on the boardwalk in Laguna Beach. And Big Jack, some of you may have known Big Jack. He helped a lot of guys. And I saw him, and I started seeing AA people on the boardwalk. And I remember I had seen sober people at the grocery store a lot in Laguna. And they all had this, like, thing in their eyes. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about, but, like, there were a couple guys that had, like, sober, they were on fire, and they were passionate about what they were doing, and their eyes were just like super bright. And I remember I'd see these guys, and I started seeing you happy people, you know, the sober people. And Jack put his hand out, and I remember thinking, oh, Jack's, he wants me to ask him to be my sponsor. That's what's going on. That's how self-centered I am. You know, I'm sure Jack was thinking like, oh, okay, man. And he just kind of passed me on. And I knew I had to ask somebody. I needed help. And we had a family friend, my stepmother's boyfriend. And this guy had been a bad dude. He had been a bartender and a coke dealer in Malibu in the 70s. And he called himself later. He told me he was a bottom dweller for 10 years, lived in some crappy converted garage for 10 years. And he said he just ground on the bottom for 10 years, just ugly, all the dirty stuff that we do. And then he got sober. But when I called him, he had 10 years sober, which might as well have been 10,000 years. It was unbelievable to me to have 10 years sober. And he was happy. He was one of those guys who had a full passion for what he was doing in life. And I called him and he picked up. And his name's Craig. Craig S. from Redondo Beach. Helped a lot of guys, Craig. And he's still around. He's in Texas now. Anyway. And I said, Craig, my girlfriend left. I hate my job. I never made it as a musician. I'm really depressed. Every movie I see reminds me of her. He told me later I was whining, but I just was listing my problems. And at the end, I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, I've been waiting for you to call. And then he said, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? Right? Like, what? I remember thinking this guy clearly has not listened to my like very valid laundry list of real problems. And victory, that sounds like it's probably in the book somewhere. I didn't know. But fortunately, my current sponsor, he's had to do a lot of work to stay sober. He goes to meetings, he sponsors a lot of guys, he goes on men's retreats, he has commitments. Like, this guy's all about it. And he says, but he was gifted one thing, and that's willingness. And I'll never, it's funny, I get emotional even thinking about it, because it was such a turning point for me. I had been gifted the gift of willingness and didn't even know it. So when Craig said, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? I just said, okay. I've got no plans. I don't know what that means. Are we going to hook up at your place? Like, whatever. Okay, just help me. And he said, great. Come to my place this Saturday and be there at 10. Can you do that? And I said, yeah, my calendar's wide open. No girls knocking on my door or anything like that. Because at that time, I'm spending a lot of time drinking. And I had a friend who had shown me how to make crack. So I spent a lot of time in my walk-in closet. None of my friends wanted to score for me anymore because I was just I didn't want to hang out with them because I don't want to share. You know what I mean? I'm at home. I'm on lockdown, man. I'm on curtain patrol. Like, it's bad. I can't leave because I'm still holding. You know, that kind of situation. And I can't do anything. And I've got the white pasty skin. I've got the post-traumatic asphalt tattoo. I got long hair and a little sensitive ponytail because I was a musician. And it's just a wreck, right? I'm a fucking train wreck. And I said, yeah, I'll be there. And for the next year, I spent every Saturday with this guy. Craig S. from Redondo Beach saved my life. Now, I know eventually I had to find a higher power, but that day, Craig S. was my higher power. And so I go meet with this guy. And I remember Craig saw me the first time, and he could tell I needed to get outside. He used to talk a lot about vitamin D for some reason. I didn't understand why, but what he meant was, like, you need to get some sun. So he'd get me outside on a bike, and there's a boardwalk there. So we'd get on the bike and go on the boardwalk. And Craig was sober a long time, so it took 5 minutes. And he's like, hey, how you doing? He knew all the sober people on the boardwalk. And he'd get me a cheeseburger, and then we'd get back to his place. And we'd start studying the book. And I'd been in book study, so I knew, like, you know, can we just get to the solutions in 60 or 62, right? I mean, and he'd sit me down. He got me, like, a highlighter and pen, and we're sitting across from each other. And he gets me reading the forewords. And I'm like, the forewords? Like, what does that have to do? Isn't the good stuff later? And I'm getting a little anxious because I don't know about you, but when I'm new, and still today, I want to feel better now, or maybe within 5 minutes. That's about the length of time I'm willing to wait. And all of a sudden, Craig just got up and walked away. And I remember thinking, oh, shit, did I do something wrong? Like, I need this guy. It turns out he just had asthma. He had to get his inhaler. And he came back, and I was all ears. Okay, I'm in. And this guy showed me how he stayed sober. And never once, and I don't know if he knew, I was one of those like, please help me, don't tell me what to do guys. But he never told me what to do, he just showed me. And so we'd study the book. And then we'd have some cookies and some coffee, we'd study the book some more, and he'd send me to a meeting, or we'd go to a meeting together, and then he'd send me. And then I'd go back the next week. And he'd start saying things like, hey, I go to a really good men's stag meeting on Monday. What men's stag meeting do you go to? I don't know. Can I get back to you next week? He said, great. It was all suggestions. You know what I mean? He was modeling to me what to do. And eventually we got into the steps. Step one, powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. That was not a problem for me. Are you kidding? I'm Asphalt Andy every morning. I got to look at this. And life's unmanageable. I had that 86 Honda Civic. It was $38 to register that car. I couldn't get that together. And I don't know if it's because it was a check, and I don't know what the deal was, but I eventually got pulled over, and they just said, you haven't registered your car in 2.5 years. We're just going to take your car for a month. And I, okay. Like, I don't have any fight left. You know what I mean? I don't know what to do. And so they took my car for a month. So yeah, life's unmanageable. Not a problem. I was working the steps with somebody, I think about 10 years ago, and we got to the second step. And I had like a new thought about the second step that I don't remember Craig telling me. And that was that the second step says, came to believe. And I really like that. I wish he had pointed this out to me. Because to me, came to believe means that I do not currently believe. I'm going to believe later. But came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. No problem with the insanity part. The stuff I'm seeing at night and the crazies, you know, it's okay. But so to me, it was step two, just it's, I don't believe that, but I believe you do. And I believe Craig did. And so I kept going. And before I know it, he's got me by the hand and we're reading the third step together. And he had one of those apartments, like a Melrose Place apartment with a pool in the middle. And he was on the first floor with a big window and he had the curtains open. And I'm like a curtain patrol kind of guy. Like, I don't want to be seen. And I remember thinking, he's got me by the hands. We're praying. And I remember thinking, what if somebody sees us in here? Like, anybody would care. You know what I mean? Like, the paranoia didn't go away. But to me, turning my will and my life over to a power that I don't understand yet, I had a lot of trouble with that. So he introduced me to the Joe and Charlie tapes. And I still listen to these a lot. I've got them on my iPod. When I'm in the backcountry on backpacking trips, I listen to them all the time. And I don't know if it's Joe or Charlie who said this, but their thing is, I'm going to turn my thoughts and actions over to a higher power. And to me, that was a little more palatable. Like, that opened the door just enough that I was like, okay, I think that works for me. And eventually I changed, at least for me, to I turn the results of my thoughts and actions over to a power that I don't understand. Because I've got thoughts, I know a lot of those, but I've got to take some action. When I was new, I had 3 years of unpaid taxes on my desk just sitting there. And I would look at them all the time and then try to do something else because I was afraid that the results wouldn't be good. I couldn't take action anymore. And so I started to get into the steps. And I remember I found a tax preparer for me. Now, remember, I'm a musician. I'm making $50 a night if I'm lucky. So that there wasn't a big tax bill there. But I was able to actually take that action and make big changes in my life just a little bit at a time. And before I knew it, he showed me how to do the first time. And I learned that I wasn't such a bad guy and that I had a part in everything, which means I wasn't a victim and I could actually move forward. I was just talking to a guy, we did a Zoom meeting, a newcomer on Saturday morning, and we were talking about the effects of the fourth column of the fourth step. And I didn't know with your fifth step, most of the time you just, it's one sitting. Craig lived with Redondo, and I remember I told him, hey, man, I'm ready to do my fifth step. It's been almost a year. And he said, great, come next week. So I did. We got through my first page, and he fell asleep. And I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? So he said, just come back next week. We'll finish. It took three sittings to get through my whole fifth step with this guy. And I had a friend, David, in my men's stag meeting. I remember he was one of those guys who says, hey, what step are you on? After the meeting, what step are you on, Andy? And I said, I'm on my fifth step. He's like, well, have you done it? I'm like, yeah, well, I met with him once. He told me to come back. He thought I was lying. He's like, well, what are you talking about? You either do your fifth step or you don't. He didn't realize that I had the, you know, ultra thorough sponsor. For six and seven, I hooked it back up with a higher power that I didn't understand yet, which wasn't a problem. And when I did the eight step, thank goodness, and nine, I had a sponsor who had suggested that I do the steps in order. Because I was one of those guys, when I was new, I wanted to go make some amends. Because I want you to like me again and maybe get back together with me. No longer. And fortunately, I didn't do that. I did them in order. And he also had me write my list. And I do an amends a week usually. And he said, you know, before you do them, what my sponsor did was have me, you know, check what I was going to say. And so I remember running some of these amends by him. And the big one was the girl who had broken up with me. And it turns out she worked at the Orange County Juvenile Justice Department. She was an attorney. And she was one of those really good people. So she was trying to help the kids and stuff. You know, he helped me kind of craft something to say to her. And I called her. And she took my call. And I tried to explain, hey, I'm on my ninth step. I'm sober now. And I'd really appreciate it. I'd be humbly grateful if you would please. And she said, you got a sponsor? I was like, geez, man, because her dad was sober a long time. She knew my game. And so she wanted to make sure I met business. And I did. And she agreed to meet with me. And I'll never forget. I went and met with her. And my experience has been very similar to this with every amends I've made. I explained what was going on, the purpose of our meeting. And I was very grateful that she was there. And when I was done, she said, Andy, I did a lot of bad stuff too. And, you know, it was a really good connection. And when she did that, she had lifted her hand up on top of the coffee table where we were, and I didn't realize until then that she was wearing this giant diamond ring. And she was engaged. And that's when I realized, like, oh, man, I thought somewhere in the back of my head, I thought she's going to see how great I am. And, right? The transformation had not been complete yet. I was still pretty selfish. And so I dropped her off, and I remember I started crying like a bitch, like a baby. Just, and I just found some park and like sat down for, I don't know, just crying, man. It was like I was really sad about it. But the good thing is, AA did for me once again what I couldn't do, because it was great. I'd never seen her again, talked to her. It was done. It was over, man. It was time for me to move on. And I did. And I started to get the feeling of some of those promises. And I started to feel like I was really part of it. And with the 10th step, I remember sitting down with my sponsor. And the big thing for me, I understand the 10th step, apply 1 through 9 to your life, right? And I started sitting with my sponsor because I'm going to make some big changes in my life. And he taught me how to use the steps to make huge changes in my life. And I'd been a musician, and I taught 100 students a week, a lot of kids and people who didn't really, they were there because their parents wanted them to be and stuff. And every student just reminded me, man, like, Andy, apparently you weren't good enough. You're teaching us. You know, it's just, oh, my God. And I really wanted to make some changes in my life. And the singer in my college band had started a company. And at that time, he needed to train someone in his house because he had little kids, but he needed to do with somebody he knew that he could trust. And he still trusted me. So he trained me in 1998 to do the business that he does. And after 6 months, he sent me out on my own. And I've had that same business for 26 years. Can't believe it. It just happened to be a good fit. But David D is my current sponsor. He's been my sponsor for 24 years. I've been sitting with this guy in the same stack right next to him for all those years. Because early on, when I had 2 years, I needed a local guy. And so I asked him. And eventually I got like 4 or 5 years, and I realized I didn't have any game, and I wanted to start dating, and he taught me how to use the steps to bring a better guy to the table. Because what I had always thought was, I got to find someone who's hot. That's the test, I guess. And he turned it around for me, and he said, why don't you work on seeing if you can bring something a little better to the table, and then take it to the next step. Why don't you work on finding someone that you are specifically able to make happy? What are you doing to make somebody else happy, right? Just turn it around. Don't sponsor her, but you know what I mean? Like, be of service, you know? And so I started dating, and I met this wonderful girl when I was 35 years old. And then I went on a backpacking trip for a couple of weeks and didn't call her soon enough. There was some book she'd read about the rules. And she never called me back. And I re-met her. I got lucky. I re-met her again 2 years later. And by then I was like, oh, okay. And we were married like 6 months later. And we've been married 17 years. 17 years, man. And I look forward to seeing her at the end of the day. I mean, we have a really good thing. And of course, we've had our challenges and stuff. And one of the things that happened for us is we got married, we wanted to have a family. And that didn't work out for us. It didn't happen that way. And I remember thinking, this is really bad. And I started to get really depressed. And my basic daily routine turned into couch, work for like an hour, and then go to AA. I never stopped going to AA meetings. And I remember at about that same time, the recovery van started coming and showing up with a bunch of guys, a bunch of young newcomer guys at the meetings I was going to. And I remember I met a guy and he said, will you be my sponsor? And I remember thinking, what is it that I have that you could possibly want? I can't stand being me right now. I'm barely making it through every day. I don't know what you want. But instead I said, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol, right? And he said, yeah. I said, all right, walk this way. And that's turned into a huge part of my life. Because I didn't have kids, it turned out to be a way that I could be of service more to the people in the meetings I go to. And so now I go to a beginner's meeting every Wednesday. And it started slowly, but now there's three tables of guys, and I sponsor most of those guys, and they sponsor. You know how it works, right? It's like this big, it's like a disease of AA or like a virus. And the deal is, what I found is if I tell a newcomer, hey, are you going to be at that meeting? Yeah. Oh, okay. Is that your commitment? Yeah. If they make a commitment to me, I have no choice. I got to be there. So all these guys keep me sober. You know what I mean? It's like an accountability partnership with all these guys. About that same time, my friends were all having little kids, and I used to backpack with them, and they stopped going backpacking. So I started going by myself. And I remember going on this backpacking trip 4 days, and I brought like a book and an iPod. I didn't use any of that stuff because I learned a little bit about meditation at these men's retreats I was going to. And I used to think meditation was observe the mind and do everything to stop the mind from thinking. You know what I mean? Just quiet it down. And what they taught me was like, just let it run. Just let it spin and just observe neutrally. And so I went into the wilderness by myself. And the first day I'm doing these walking meditations, these little basic techniques they taught me. And I'm just observing the mind like train cars, just thoughts going by. And I didn't realize you can have thoughts and just go like, oh, thanks for sharing. I always thought I had to do whatever that thought said. Right? And I had some crazy thoughts out there. The first day was money. Do I have enough money? Am I going to have enough money later? Can I have your money? Like it was all, you know, oh my God. And then the next day was resentments, you know, my wife or friends or that guy cut me off or, you know, resentments. And the third day was somehow, I don't remember what the third day was, but the fourth day, I was 15 miles out and I was in the Yosemite backcountry and I was at high altitude and it was a slow, easy, moderate hike all day back down to Yosemite Valley. And it was June of 2011 and it was a really big snow year and they had just let people back into the backcountry. So all of the waterfalls are booming and all of the creeks are like swollen and right next to the trail. And so I'm hiking all day next to these huge silent bodies of energy and water. And I'm like, okay, this is good. And I start looking around and breathing and I can smell the forest. And I start looking around and there's these giant granite walls. It's called Little Yosemite Valley, if anybody familiar with it. Big fire since then, but back then it was really beautiful. And there's all these little mini waterfalls coming off the granite. And I'm starting to really kind of trip out on this. And I see a red, black, and white striped snake just go across the way, which I guess they just come out when the snow's done or something. I'd never seen it before. And I'm like, all right, that's pretty cool. And there's these things called snow flowers that only come out right after the snow's melted. And they're this crazy bright neon red pink, the whole thing, the stalk, the flower, and they're big and they come out of the, and I'm seeing that for the first time and I'm really tripping out. And I started to realize, right, so I had this thought, what would happen if I'm observing my mind and it runs out of stuff to think about? And for, I think maybe 10 minutes, I had my first experience where I had complete peace and serenity, a complete absence of me. And then I went right back to thinking about myself, as we do. And I realized that that's what I had been looking for with all the booze and the drugs and the hallucinogenics that I was treating my alcoholism with, which is not a good dark place to go, and all the stuff I was doing, this is what I had been looking for. It's just complete peace. And so I still go back every summer for 2 weeks by myself and go do walk meditation all day. And so by doing that every summer all those years, I've climbed Whitney a bunch of times, done the John Muir Trail this year, High Road, I've climbed a bunch of mountains. Like, I love it out there, man. That's where my heart. So at the end of Appendix 2, the spiritual condition, at the very bottom, a couple of years ago, I was reading this with somebody, and I can't believe I never noticed this. It says, we come to find an unsuspected inner resource that we've come to identify as our higher power, an unsuspected inner resource. And I underlined it and highlighted unsuspected inner resource. And I'd never thought about that because I was always looking out there. But what I found is it was here. It was here all along. I just needed to come to AA and learn how to work a program and learn how to get out of my own way to finally have access. So, thank you.